All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and the brand new Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. And I've recorded more than 5,500 interviews since 2003, almost all on foreign policy, and all available for you at scotthorton.org. You can sign up for the podcast feed there, and the full interview archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, you guys, I got Dan McAdams on the line. He is the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, and he's a significant part of the reason why Ron Paul has been so good on everything this whole century long. Of course, Ron Paul's principles are great, and he reads a lot and knows everything, but also he's had Dan as his foreign policy advisor in his congressional office for all through the Bush and Obama years and all of that. And then, of course, his right-hand man on the Liberty Report, their great show on YouTube every day and at ronpaullibertyreport.com. The wonderful and excellent and awesome and banned from Twitter, Daniel McAdams. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, sir?
Hi, Scott. It's great to be back with you.
Very happy to have you here, as always. And, you know, so I saw a thing, which was an interview of you on, I forget now, maybe it was on RT or something. And the bottom line of it was, when it comes to all the scaremongering about China and the rise of their power in the world, you are unimpressed. And I wonder why that's so.
Well, I mean, we went through 20 years of the war on terror, and you knew from the beginning, and we knew that it was all BS. It was all an excuse for Washington to continue milking the rest of the country so it can live better than the rest of us underlings. And that started to peter out. So we went back to a few years ago, we went back to, oh, well, China and Russia actually are our big enemies now. We're going to do something different. We're going to keep the money flowing. We're going to keep building those mansions in McLean. You know, suck it up, America. And that's why it's completely bogus. That's one of them, because we know who's behind it. We know what's going on with them. We know what their motivations are. And the other is that if you look at China, it doesn't behave the way the China hawks in the U.S. claim it does. That's not its modus operandi. And, you know, they always get it wrong, and they get it wrong again.
Yeah, but red flag, CCP, evil, commie, dictatorship. So how can we expect anything less than the absolute worst, Dan?
And you forgot virus exporters, right? The CCP virus.
There you go.
That's what the Epic Times calls it, you know, and of course, you know, there's something really sick in the psychology of Americans, many Americans, not all Americans, but they have this sort of victimhood mentality because we are the one indispensable nation, as Madeleine Albright would say. We always have to have terrible enemies, Dr. Evils out there who want to vanquish us. And so we have to always be on our guard, and we have to always make sure that the military is topped up and tapped up. And we have to always continue spending $300 million a day in Afghanistan. Oh, wait, that's over. We got to do something else and find somewhere else to dump our money into. And it's just round and round it goes. And it's, you know, we've been beating our heads against the wall for so long on this. And I don't know what it'll take to wake Americans up, because we keep seeing failure after failure until you start realizing that actually failure is a success. You know, as Dylan said, there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, I swear at this point, I'm kind of afraid to move a muscle because, you know, we agitate for so long about pulling out of Afghanistan, and we finally, this argument finally gained some purchase inside the foreign policy establishment. And yet, I know you've seen it 100 times as much as me. In every article where they're taking our side on Afghanistan, it ends with, that way we can focus more on the pivot to China, the real enemy. And not that I would say it's fair to sacrifice innocent Afghans just to keep our army busy, but it might be, you know, if it comes down to a real war between America and China, then God dang, man, we might have made a real mistake doing the right thing here, Dan.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the danger always is the case of Washington believing its own mythology. And that's what we saw for 20 years in Afghanistan. Washington believed the lies it told itself and convinced itself. And I think you handled this on the Kennedy Show not long ago, if I'm not mistaken, including the idea that we've trained 300,000 expert Afghan soldiers. And that was, I think, the basis upon which the entire evacuation, the entire disengagement was formed. The lies that the generals told, they must have known better. They had to know better. We know the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction had been telling us for years that this thing was bogus, but Washington continues, it believes its mythology. And I think that's the danger of a war with China, is that there's no clear thinking, there's no clear heads. It's all about, you know, putting down a mythology, believing the mythology. You know, it's like a religion.
Yeah. Honestly, man, I think that's such an important point about, in a way, the decentralized sort of ad hoc bumbling nature of the empire there. Not in a sense that it makes them innocent of anything, but just that it's sort of such an unorganized kind of chaos, the empire, just because its size, if nothing else, that it really makes it unpredictable in a lot of ways. I used to, when I was much more of a conspiracy kook in the 1990s, I would always really resent it as like patronizing, you know, kind of BS when people would say, well, you know, people who believe that the Council on Foreign Relations controls everything, essentially, that's to make them feel better, like somebody's in control of the thing when nobody really is. And now I realize, well, not now, but about 20 years ago, I realized that that really is right. That, you know what, I would feel better if there was some former Secretary of State or something at the head of some secret table who had some kind of veto power over the way this goes. I know it's supposed to be the president, but it ain't him. So no. Who's in charge? Who's driving this aircraft carrier? Kind of a lot of different people. And who knows what they might do, you know?
That's a good point. And you also make a good point about the danger. And I think there is a danger right now because we've seen the mask slip a bit from the foreign policy establishment and the entire foreign policy ethos of Washington. We've seen that despite spending $1 trillion a year on the military, despite, you know, saturating the entire culture and population with military worship, when it comes time to actually do something, they're not very good at it. The U.S. foreign policy establishment, the military, the entire edifice upon which, you know, the modern empire, the U.S. empire is built, is actually very rickety and can't do simple things like evacuate people properly, like doing basic things that it should do. And I think that's dangerous because I think when that mask slips, as you say, the internal chaos that the whole thing is built on is looking for a way to reinforce that, oh, yes, we can do things. And I think that's the danger that we're facing right now.
Yeah, seriously. All right. But so, you know, seriously, as a devil's advocate argument, though, what about that it is the evil old communist dictatorship there in Beijing and that they must be as greedy and ruthless as any collection of government runners anywhere in the world? And so what is stopping them from attacking all of their neighbors and all of our friends and eventually coming here?
Yeah, why haven't they done anything yet like that? That's the thing. We've been demonstrating that that's our method of operation for decades. The Chinese haven't done that. They do go overseas, but they go with business contracts. You know, they go to Africa and say, hey, we want to buy some of your stuff. We want to, you know, and maybe they're ruthless in the way they drive their deals. Okay, that's not illegal. Maybe they're unethical. Okay, that's questionable. But they don't go to Africa with bombers. They go with, say, we need some rare earth. You know, we need whatever. And they do that. They go to South America. They make deals. So the whole idea that they're ruthless commies, ironically, and I've said this before, Scott, ironically, the things that I think really are bad and dangerous about China are the very things that we're importing here into the U.S., which is the social credit system. If you happen to be a political dissident, i.e. you have any question at all about the ruling class, then you're a terrorist and you need to prove your loyalty. All of the bad things about China we're importing, and all of the good things about China we're condemning. You know, its business ethos, it's the idea that of building, of doing business, of really the state getting out of the way, which it does more in China. I would bet, and I don't have the data in front of me, Scott, but I would bet it's a hell of a lot easier to start a business in China than it is here in the U.S. So, yes, there are problems there, but those are the problems we're emulating rather than the positive aspects of China.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that you guys are big David Stockman fans over there at the Ron Paul Institute, and I try to read him as much as I can, but he's so prolific, I can't quite keep
up.
But I know that his description of China's economy is, don't bother me with your predictions of their, you know, imminent takeover of anything, you know, for a minute. He's so cynical about it. He calls the whole country the China Ponzi. Like, it's not even a nation state. It's just a giant Greenspan bubble. And it's ready to pop at any time. And I know he's always saying that every bubble is ready to pop at any time. But then again, usually he's right. And so I don't know when it's coming, but it seems like that's the libertarian insight that conservatives lack. You know, this is, in fact, even in the famous Ron Paul piece, well, I'm sorry, now I forget if it's in War Peace and the State, or if it's in Chapter 14, War and Foreign Policy from the Libertarian Manifesto. But in one or the other of those, it begins with, why would the conservatives think that time is on the communist side? Like, if you know anything about capitalism, then you know why it works and why communism doesn't work and can't work. And so time's on our side. We should just strengthen capitalism here and not turn our country into a total state in the name of protecting ourselves from the communists, when, you know, as libertarians especially understand that, well, I don't know, man. This is my point of view. I guess it's really essentially like the Austrian school's point of view, right, Dan? Is that essentially any government intervention in the market is a distortion that's going to cause ripple effects and whatever. Maybe you think it's worth it. Maybe you think it's, you don't. It's not. But you have what would be all other things equal in the free market, and then you have government intervention distorting that. Well, if that's true, it sure seems like it from here in this country, then think about the real ramshackle nature of the political economy in China, where all these decisions are made by, well, I don't know all of them. Many of these decisions are made by bureaucrats, all of them in cooperation and consultation with bureaucrats, in a way that probably blows American interventionism away, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, I suspect, you know, from my experience following China, and I did take a 2-week trip to China when I was in Congress with Dr. Paul. And of course, you know, those can be dog and pony shows. I understand that. But everything that I heard from business and from government was that government likes to get out of the way. And I'm not praising China, because you're probably right. The whole world is based on a huge bubble, you know, but I think there's this tendency of seeing the splinter in someone else's eye rather than the log in your own. So, you know, in a sense, it's irrelevant whether China is practicing better capitalism than we are or not, because I think, especially as foreign policy practitioners, especially as non-interventionist foreign policy practitioners, our whole, you know, reason for being is to blunt the China hawks in any way we can.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. All right. Well, I guess I ought to ask you about different countries in the Middle East and, you know, what's going on there and what people need to be concerned or not about. I mean, especially in terms of Iraq and Syria, where we still have forces. And what exactly are they doing in Syria, Dan?
Well, didn't you hear the president? He said we don't have any troops there.
Did he say that?
Yeah, he did. He said, we don't have any troops in Syria.
Wow, I wonder if they told him that, or he's just that stupid, or if they told him that.
Wow. Yeah, that was the famous Stephanopoulos interview.
Oh, see, I didn't see that. I need to turn the TV back on,
I guess. Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't watch the whole thing, but there's been a lot written about it. Apparently, ABC left out a lot of the more embarrassing things that he said that were just completely gone and completely off base. But, you know, hey, I mean, it's a complicated world out there, and the idea that one president, you know, can you know, immediately talk about every hot spot. You know, that's kind of ridiculous. But when you see more and more of these gaffes, then you start to wonder. And the other thing that he said, and going back to China, is he said that the U.S. would respond if Taiwan was invaded. And that's not been our policy. It's always been, as you know, strategic ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And so he was corrected by his staff again. So it's a long sort of joking answer, but he's getting a lot of these things wrong. So it's probably good that he is on vacation again this weekend.
Man, I'll tell you what, this is the problem of having such a senile president. But I think they all kind of make that gaffe over Taiwan and walk it back, don't they? I think Bush and Trump both did the same thing at one point.
Yeah, I mean, well, I know you're the expert everywhere, but I'm not. I'm sure I'd make a hell of a lot of gaffes if I was in there too. But yeah, it's starting to get to be a little bit difficult to ignore. But yeah, what are we doing in Syria? What are we doing in Iraq? Is it just inertia? I mean, how much did inertia drive our endless occupation of Afghanistan? You know, I mean, there's just no will. I mean, what about dealing with the Iranians? What about the JCPOA talks? You know, it's just, I don't know how you feel, Scott, but I have a sense that there's absolutely no vision of the U.S. role in the world with the current people in charge of the State Department, you know, and the Pentagon. I mean, previously we've had that idea of a worldview, and a lot of it was, again, mythology, the mythology of the Obama era versus the reality of droning Americans overseas, the Bush era of, you know, the global war on terror. But I don't know. I mean, I try to put my finger on someone like Blinken, and I just don't get anything. It's like Kierkegaard said about existence, it smells of nothing, right?
You know, yeah, I think that really does seem to be right, that they don't really know what they're doing. They're scrambling to hold things together, but then they don't even know what that means. This is the part that I never understand, really, especially, well, like for W. Bush, forget it. He was doing exactly what he wanted and things like that. But for Obama, I know, and not that I'm saying he's a good person or anything, but just he's smart enough and well-informed enough to know better than a lot of the things that he did. And he's also smart enough to be, you know, probably unlike W. Bush. I think he's smart enough to spend time thinking, damn, I had 8 years and it's already over. And what I had to show for it, what I really do, what could I have stopped that I didn't or whatever. You know, I hope he beats himself up over that stuff. But I just think, like, because it's so obvious, right? They tell us all in school that any of us could grow up to be the president. So you think about it. Well, if I was the president, I would make it worth it. for whatever it took for me to become the president, I would, you know, be in trouble every single day for 8 years. You know, and or maybe less, but yeah, I just can't think of, like, imagine being the national security advisor and being like, well, I don't know. You know what I mean? I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I totally agree with you. They don't know what in the hell to do.
Yeah. The thing that we've seen, though, you know, and this is not an excuse for the person, but I think it's an insight into how the establishment works, is that even when you had a president who wanted to do something, the whole thing about Ukraine policy, the whole first impeachment of Trump was that he did not follow the consensus of the community. And, you know, that, I mean, that was literally what they said. That's literally what Vindman said. And that's literally why he was impeached. So there is the idea of how much power does a president actually have.
Right. Hey, listen, I'm so glad that you said that, because out of all of that testimony and all of that hype, you just picked the most important sentence out of that whole thing, which I think is exactly right, which is when Vindman says that, look, the president was changing the policy, but we at the interagency, we had already decided what the policy was. And then he was going to make it different? I mean, that's illegal. You can't do that. And that was his thing. I don't remember the exact quote, but that was exactly what it was. And that was why, in this guy's mind, he really thought that, what right does the president have to decide foreign policy? when the interagency, which what does that even mean exactly? That just means like a meeting of the deputies committee or what, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, it was really incredible insight. And he was the main one, but it was really a procession of people trotted out that said exactly the same thing. As you say, yeah, the interagency. It went against interagency's, a consolidated view, what have you, and over. And that, I think, was a real eye-opener. And I think, you know, Trump brought a lot of that on himself because of his style. He had a polarizing style. I think, obviously, Obama was more effective because he didn't have that polarizing style. But, I mean, Obama got a couple of really good things done for policy. Trump, even the stuff that he was good on, he was not able to do anything about, really, you know, dealing with Russia, getting out of Afghanistan, getting out of Syria. But yeah, it is a real eye opener. And then when you step back and you look at these agencies and their budgets and the personnel, you know, imagine the biggest pain in the ass you've ever known, who's always bothering you, who just never can chill out, and multiply that by tens of thousands. And that's Washington, D.C. You know, I just finished reprinting a piece that Jim Bovar did. I think you guys ran it yesterday on antiwar.com.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most profound things I've ever read. It's just simply Jim Bovar sitting at the towpath, and one of the typical Washington foreign policy establishment person comes in there and just happens to be getting ready to go for a jog, and Jim engages her in conversation. The way he describes it is exactly as I remember my 13 years in Washington dealing with these people. He's captured it exactly, and that's exactly the problem with all these people. They all consider themselves way smarter than us, way better than us, and way more accomplished than us, and they don't. The last thing they want to do is have to listen to us.
Yep.
And they don't.
Amazing.
They'll never get fired. You know, we can't even find them. They're all hidden.
Hey, y'all, check out our great stuff at libertarianinstitute.org/books. First of all, we've published No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg, our institute's late and great co-founder. He was the very best one of us. Our whole movement, I mean. And No Quarter will leave his mark on you, no question. Which brings us to the works of our other co-founder, the legendary libertarian thinker and writer Sheldon Richman. We've published two collections of his great essays, Coming to Palestine and What Social Animals Owe to Each Other. Both are instant classics. I'm proud to say that Coming to Palestine is surely the definitive libertarian take on Israel's occupation of the Palestinians, and Social Animals certainly ranks with the very best writings on libertarian ethics, economics, and everything else. You'll absolutely love it. Then there's me. I've written two books, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. And I've also published a collection of the transcripts of all of my interviews of the heroic Dr. Ron Paul, 29 of them, plus a speech by me about how much I love the guy. It's called The Great Ron Paul. You can find all of these at libertarianinstitute.org/books. Yeah, you know, back when Twitter was a little bit newer, I got a response one time. I forgot what he said now. I did get a little bit of engagement from Jake Tapper one or two times. And I'm pretty sure one of them was when I said to him about the Syrian war in 2013, that he was phrasing it. I forgot who he was interviewing, but he was saying, what can you say to convince the American people to support this? This is, of course, after the Turkish and Al-Qaeda false flag in eastern Damascus there. And, and that was the whole frame. And then so I sent a tweet to him. Hey, man, how come it has to be the frame of what can we do to get the American people on board for this thing instead of don't you have to not do this because the American people don't want you to do it? It seems like that would at least be just as fair of a way to approach it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then, so I saw him interviewing McMaster, and McMaster saying, oh, yeah, this is all everybody's fault but mine and all this kind of thing. And Tapper outright says to him, he goes, look, I mean, we can't ignore. This is right after Biden's speech on Monday.
Uh-huh.
We can't ignore that a supermajority of the American people say the war's not worth fighting. And, you know, here we're saying this war is to create a democracy in Afghanistan. The democracy here is saying that we want to quit. So what would you say about that, you know?
They're all idiots.
Yeah, and in fact, it's better than that because he even says, I'm paraphrasing here, but he makes it pretty explicit that, like, look, McMaster, I'm with you, okay? Your job and my job here is to convince the American people to love this stuff. Nobody's disputing that. However, I have to play devil's advocate here, if only to set you up to give you a chance to explain why we should ignore the supermajority public opinion of the people, you know, essentially is the way the thing was phrased. So he's just totally admitting that he's on Team McMaster here. Nobody's questioning that. Everybody can tell. Every watching knows that. But still, don't we kind of owe an answer for that? And then McMaster's answer, of course, is, well, Biden should lead and just do what I say instead, you know, and just ignore the, we got to go create a democracy in Afghanistan by ignoring the one that we got here, supposedly, you know. But so yeah, Tapper's just making it clear whose side he's on and speaking for all of the rest of them too, that, hey,
yeah,
you know, this is our business, is making you guys love war. The funny thing is they make it so obvious that that really is their primary concern. You know, Dave Smith said that on the Kennedy show last night. Like, you notice they only get all human rightsy and really upset when we leave a war. I mean, come on. We've been killing people over there all this time. Now you're upset that people are dying? Come on, dude.
Yeah. It's frustrating, but, you know, he's got the bully pulpit, and we're basically banging on the doors on the outside trying to get someone to listen to us. You know, but what's ironic is how ill-informed the Washington foreign policy establishment is. You know, the experts are. They all read the same things. They all, you know, like McMaster, I bet, you know, they never expose themselves to anything that questions a preconceived view. And so, ironically, the people who think they're so smart are actually among the worst informed people in the country.
Yep. Yeah, Ellsberg talks about that in his book Secrets about Vietnam, about how, especially if you have classified access to this or that, then you can look down your nose at anyone else out in the public who only has access to open source type information because, well, you don't know what I know. But then that self-reinforcing little loop and bubble means that, yeah, well, you don't know what I know either. And I learn from reading antiwar.com every day over the long term a context that CIA briefers won't give you, you know?
Yeah.
Chalmers Johnson used to say that. Chalmers Johnson used to say, man, I used to write the morning brief for the CIA. I used to be part of that or read them all the time too. Cause he was a contractor, I guess, for the CIA, a USC professor. And he goes, antiwar.com is better than any CIA brief in terms of just like information about what you want to know going on in the world. And it's just cause Eric Garris's taste in news items and the order he puts them in and letting you know was the deal. You know what I mean? It's all there.
Yeah.
You might know a secret if you have the access, but you're much more likely to have the wisdom of who's who and what's really going on around here if you're reading open source stuff from wide and varied sources, you know?
Exactly. But then you're not in the club, you know?
Right.
I mean, strangely enough, I mean, I did have access once and I did write for the Secretary of State's morning summary on several occasions when I was at the State Department. And I can say, you know, if I had my classified and my unclassified stacks side by side, the classified was no great shakes, right? The other was much more helpful and much more useful. And you're right. I mean, just the average person reading anti-war. I remember when I worked for Dr. Paul on the Hill, I would always show up to the hearings, you know, especially when he was higher up. And so I was sitting in the back behind him and I would sit next to my colleagues. And I know I've told this story before, but I would go there with my stack of stuff to read while I was waiting. And I was reading antiwar.com and Lou Rockwell, you know, and Counterpunch and all this stuff. And I look around and every single other staffer was reading Washington Post, New York Times, the same crap warmed over. And I'm thinking, you guys are foreign policy people. You should get past this boilerplate stuff and really try to get a good, decent knowledge of it. Nobody wanted that. That's no way to get your career move forward.
Right. Isn't that funny? Just stick with that point real quick there. So if I was a staffer for a congressman, And I decided, like you, that, hey, I want to learn a thing or two about the war that we're in right now. Now, that's no way to advance your career. That'll make you a dork and a nerd and not one of the cool kids right away. Is that it?
You might start questioning things. You know, you might say something that you know, others don't want to hear. Your boss is only there for 2-year intervals. You can be there for life if you play your cards right. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're really smart, you'll be in there for a few years and then you move over to the quote private sector where you start really making the big bucks.
That's a lot.
You know, which is, you know, flipping your Rolodex and doing lobbying. Yeah. And then you go back in at
the private sector.
And, you know,
how dare they call it that?
I know it's, but we know. I mean, in fact, I was just chatting with Norman Singleton, my old colleague in Dr. Paul's office, the other day, and we were going over some of the people that we knew from the old days, who've just done that exact thing. And, you know, they just go back and forth, up the ladder. Next thing you know, you've got a mansion in McLean, you know, and you're doing well. You're eating at the Capitol Grill, and you know, it's a good life if you can get it.
Yeah, it doesn't sound so good to me, but I see what you mean about how much they think that that's the pinnacle and all that.
Yeah.
So now here's the thing I want to talk to you about. I actually just got off the line with Trita Parsi right before I got on the line with you. And of course, he's formerly at the National Iranian American Council and now is the co-founder and the muckety muck over there at the Quincy Institute with Basevich and them. And you had written this great article about the bad guys attacking them over the loss of Afghanistan. Was that Kelly Vlahos and Eli Clifton caused America to lose the Afghan war? Did I read that right, Dan?
It's all Kelly's fault.
Man, shame on her. Oh, wait, no. You know, she was the one who warned us all along on the specific topic of the implementation of the counterinsurgency doctrine in Afghanistan in 2009. Other than Matthew Ho, she wears the crown for told you so that year. Guaranteed.
Exactly.
You know,
and that's why we had her back several times to Dr. Paul's famous Thursday lunches on the Hill, because she was so good. She was such a great dogged reporter, and she really dug into the counterinsurgency doctrine and really exposed it for the mindless rot that it was. So
absolutely. No, right. All right. So anyway, like, so who are these goons and what are they doing messing with my friend?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a Washington Free Beacon, and they were upset. They wanted to blame someone, and they blamed Quincy because, of course, it's their fault that getting out wasn't orderly. It's never the Free Beacon's fault that 20 years of wasted lives and wasted money, you know, that's never their fault. It's only that getting out wasn't perfectly executed, you know, so... And
this.
If you read the piece that they wrote, it's amazingly void of anything specific. You know, so it's kind of depressing. I thought they'd be better at that, at attacking poor old Kelly. But no, it was pretty empty.
Yeah, I love the way you say, always, this is the way it begins, everybody. Dan says, I admit, I've always had a soft spot for the Washington Free Beacon. Not because I am attracted to their puerile content, mind you, but because I've always associated the name Free Beacon with free bacon, a proposition I believe every American could get behind. And I think that is totally right, man. I wish I had thought of that myself because I also like bacon.
You know, I kind of stole that from Lou Rockwell, too, anyway.
Oh, that's
told
good.
Me once. I should have mentioned that, but I probably stole that a little bit from him subconsciously.
That's good. Yeah, I borrow a couple of his lines from time to time myself. All right, man. So now, yeah, here's something that's important that you bring up in your piece that's worth talking about with you. Is all the Ron Paul right trending on social media and all that? Ron Paul was right, is what I meant to say. Trending on social media and repeats of his speeches about Afghanistan and all that going on this week. What do you think of that?
I think it was great. You know, I mean, it was good for nostalgia. It's good. It's good that it broke through to the mainstream. It's good. I think Newsweek ran a piece based on the trending. Good. I mean, yeah, they ran a pretty good piece on how it was trending. Ron Paul was right. It was trending. And, you know, when these things do happen, and, you know, I think we talked about this offline, is that we do feel like we're pounding our heads against the wall. And when something like this does happen, I mean, Scott Horton gets on Kennedy. People are listening to what you have to say. They're talking about your book. They're talking about Ron Paul. So it's an opportunity for us to, you know, to get in a couple of licks before they turn their heads away again.
Yeah.
And that's the real benefit, the benefit of it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it sucks that this is the conversation we're having in 2021, but you do get the idea that, and this is a lot of this, of course, first and foremost, is because of Dr. Paul, but then also because of Trump. I mean, only Trump could go on Sean Hannity's show and say, essentially to his face, this is all your fault, dum-dum, and it's all wrong, and we should have never done this. Only he says Bush, but he could have said Hannity too.
Yeah.
And tell the whole right wing that, hey, we don't have to be married to Bush's legacy anymore. Screw them Bushes, you know? And the right wing really, 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 really needed to hear that from somebody that they can look up to. And when Ron did it, I mean, Bush was still in the chair when Ron started running against him in 2008, you know, put him in a very difficult position to do that. And, you know, yeah. 12 had all its own dynamics. It was still a great success of a campaign anyway, in all its own ways. But it does seem like, you know, when I go on the Kennedy show, it isn't just that they're saying, okay, now that it's too late, we're willing to hear you out. It's not just that, but it's now that it's too late, we all really agree with you that, like, yeah, we probably shouldn't have done that. And you know, nation building, yeah, no, nation building isn't a good idea. We shouldn't be doing nation building. And, you know, I'll take it. They could just be saying that, well, we lost this one, but shut up about it or whatever. But they are sort of at least all going along with, I guess, sort of the transformation that Tucker Carlson made back 10 years ago. That, like, yeah, no, we shouldn't be doing this. I don't know. That may be too strong of a way to put it, but it just seemed like that's the idea, kind of.
And the same thing happened after it was plainly obvious that Iraq was an absolute debacle and disaster. You know, the problem is in the interim between them doing this and them finding out it was a crap idea, so many people suffer and die. So much money is lost and wasted, and so many evil people get ahead. And that's what really bothers me, too. People that serve the system, that serve the regime and profit off of it. But in between those intervals, you have all this bad stuff. I just wish we could make the intervals, you know, closer together. But yeah. But we can only do what we can, you know. And I'm sure you do, too, Scott. I get very frustrated. Why is it that we're screaming in the wilderness? Why can't we seem to get very much traction on this? But at the same time, I'm grateful for when we do get some traction, which we are getting a little traction now with the Afghanistan thing.
Yeah. You know, look, I mean, the reality is almost everybody's interested in foreign policy has got something at stake and has a conflict of interest and a reason why. They have a think tank. They got money from somebody who's trying to sell helicopters to the Pentagon. You know, that's just how business is done. The private sector, they call it, as you were referring to earlier, right? So then the only other people who are interested in foreign policy are people like us who are terribly against it and want the whole thing to stop for moral reasons and for, you know, the consequences for our own country reasons and all these kinds of things. And look, the polls say this, the super majorities agree with us. Again, how do you like that, McMaster? But the problem is, how do you get them to prioritize? It's all so far away, which is one of the reasons why that just proves we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
Right. We're supposed to be, that's one of the biggest, best things about being in America is we can mind our own business and be free and live our own lives. But our government is making East Africa our business. It is our business. We're the ones doing it to them. So what the hell? You know, I'm not saying we should intervene different, better. I'm saying it's up to us to stop it. But it's hard to get that message through to people when people have no idea that George W. Bush started a war against Somalia also 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that's only a war that's younger than our Afghan war only by 3 months, you know?
Yeah. And heating up again.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Luongo wrote a piece a couple of days ago reminding me how great Justin Raimondo was.
Hell yeah.
And remains. Quoting Justin, who said, you know, foreign policy is just war by other means. And that's classic Raimondo. And that's absolutely true. You know, in a sense, our enemy is foreign policy, foreign policy itself.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's so. Yep. Gosh, you know, I think about Justin a lot. You know, and I talk about a serious blow to our movement. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, sometimes I forget this doing this show, but there's new people listening all the time. And it's been 2 years since he died. And there are a lot of young people who, you know, they lived through that whole time way too young to have known anything about Raimondo. May have never heard of Raimondo. So,
I mean,
glad you brought him up.
A Raimondo column where all of the cylinders were firing is like, it was like the equivalent of a nuclear war against the bad guys, you know? I mean, it was just, there was nothing like it. 2,000 words of just, you know, I mean, just incredible. And it's, the loss is just, there's, you know, and now Bob Wenzel, who was so great, has gone too. It's tough to see our side, the ranks thinning out. I hope some younger folks are going to come up through the ranks, yeah, you know, pretty soon as well.
Yeah, Mark Perry just died too, man.
Yeah, Mark Perry, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, sorry to get all maudlin on you, but I just couldn't help thinking about Justin.
Yeah, no, that's true. And listen, I'm glad that you brought it up because I like to say, and I do believe, there's no question about this, that during the W. Bush years, he was the most important writer in America.
Oh, yeah.
Bar none, and by a lot.
Absolutely.
His reading Raimondo was absolutely essential. And if you weren't reading him then you didn't know what the fuck was really going on. You just didn't know. That was how you knew what was going on, for real. And through Obama, too, he started trailing off and getting lazy in late Obama, I guess. But during Bush and early Obama, I mean, that stuff will go down in history forever, man.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've ever in my life anticipated a column like I did his Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I just couldn't wait. Print it out, get on the bus, get to work, read it on the way to work. And even when he was wrong, and I disagree with him a lot, and I think he was wrong, it didn't matter because it was still, as you say, great and important writing.
Yeah. I'm the kook who put all those links in there. You wonder why I know all this stuff?
Oh, my God. People, wow, I didn't know
how
that.
Do you know all this stuff? Well, 3 days a week, I'd spend 3 hours filling a Raimondo column with proof that he was right about everything, which was easy to do because he always was. And if he wasn't, then I'd fix it.
Whoa, that's a revelation. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, some people who were actually really good people, they didn't like Raimondo's columns because there was too many links in it. They couldn't follow them all.
That's
it
my
was
fault.
Too much of an endeavor.
That's my fault.
They were helpful.
You know what? I have a disorder like this, right? It's ever since I was a little kid, and my mom would watch Perry Mason and Matlock and all that, and even Perry Mason first. That, you know, the first time I learned about the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, that anything less is cheating. You know, you gotta tell them everything. So now I'm
stuck
like this.
Those links were important because you could also go off and do some of your own research on it. I mean, that's amazing. I didn't realize that. Those links were critical, I think. Wow.
Yeah, so the way I looked at it was any assertion of fact of any kind has to be proven. So,
and I don't think anyone else was doing it like that back then. I think, you know, you guys were the only ones. Yeah, there were links here and there, but that was just, you know, nonstop.
Yeah. So that was me from, like, what, 2004 through... I finally quit doing it and... by late Obama, I guess.
Uh-huh. Wow.
But yeah, that was a good time. And, you know, of course, I interview a lot of great people like you and learn a lot of great stuff this way, too. But that certainly has helped doing all of that work. But seriously, wow. Like, you know, for you youngins, take a rainy Saturday or Sunday sometime. Take an afternoon and go back and just plow through those old Raimondo columns. Just start in 99 with the war diary on Kosovo and then just go through 2000 through 2001. And some of them you'll be able to just skim right through and go, okay, he's just fighting with, you know, some ridiculous, you know, off-brand neocon that you don't need to worry about. But other times you'll know, you'll see what I mean, what we mean about the greatness in there, man. It's, you know,
and there's plenty of laughs packed in when he goes after Tom Palmer. You can't help but laugh because he knows
that's true,
he knows
too.
Where to apply the ice pick.
Yeah, you know, actually, now that I'm talking about it, I wish I hadn't been in such a hurry to get the book out. You know, because that would have really been a smart thing to do. Would have been to go and do that myself. Take a Saturday or a Sunday and just go and jam through as many Raimondo columns as I can, looking for little things I might have forgotten that belong in there, you know?
Yeah. That might be a great project for antiwar.com, you know, the collected works of Justin Raimondo.
Well, see, that's the problem, right? Is if we're going to do that, I got to do it. And I just can't do it. I can't even answer my emails.
I know it's tough.
You know, there was even a guy actually put together a PDF file of, oh, because after he died, I did Tom Wood's show and talked all about, and I picked out, like, here's some of my favorite articles by Justin. So then this guy went and made a cool PDF version of that to print out as a book. But even then, the amount of production and the time and the editing and the all the different things that would have to go into it, I just don't have time to do. I just put it on the back burner. And maybe I'll get to it someday. You know, I don't know. But that would be great, though. You know, we call it something about Bizarro World would have to be in the title, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man.
Yeah. I was always mad at him because I used to say that on pirate radio in the 90s before I ever even read him. And then he made such good use of that term. I was like, okay, well, I guess I can't say that anymore. All right. Anyway, listen, man, you're great. I love hanging out with you and talking with you, Dan, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks, Scott. It's always great to talk to you.
All right, you guys, that is Dan McAdams. He's at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, and read his funny takedown of the Washington Free Beacon guys. Washington Free Beacon's hilarious meltdown over Afghanistan.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.